Good morning, and calling the House State Affairs Committee to order at 11:02 a.m. Saturday, February 18th, in the Max Gruenberg Room here in the Alaska Capitol. Will the Secretary please call the roll?
Representative Wolf, Representative Kopp, Representative LaVue, Representative Birch.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Tuck.
Here.
Representative Josephson.
Here.
Representative Knopf.
Here.
Chair Price Tompkins.
Here. Thank you, and Representative Ledoux is excused today, and for today, I believe the final day, Representative Josephson will be serving that committee as an alternate, and thank you, Representative Tuck, for serving as vice chair, and Representative Ledoux-Steed with 6 members. We have a quorum, and we'll be joined by other legislators today, including Representative Eastman, who's in the room. Thank you for being here. Thank you, Martha and Kelsey, for helping things go today. We have 4 items on today's agenda, 2 of which are previously heard pieces of legislation, and 2 of which will be first hearings. In order, we'll be hearing House Bill 20 relating to marriage solemnization, House Concurrent Resolution 5 relating to the uniform rules in the Committee on Committees, House Bill 44 relating to legislative conflict of interest, and House Bill 13, a piece of legislation from Representative Josephson, an erstwhile committee member. Starting off with House Bill 20, this is the second hearing, and it's my hope that we can move this piece of legislation today. We had some discussion and questions in the previous hearing, and I errantly opened public testimony. I guess it's not maybe necessarily errantly, but without it being noticed, but it was noticed for today, so I will reopen public testimony for that reason. And I think we'll start with that, in fact. So, under House Bill 20, I'm going to open public testimony. And I don't see anyone online, and I'm looking in the back of the room if anyone is online for House Bill 20. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify on House Bill 20? And seeing no one coming forward, I'm going to close public testimony on House Bill 20. With public testimony closed, we can move forward. And coming out of the last hearing, there was some discussion on one's duty and obligation, an elected official's duty or possible obligation to solemnize marriages. And coming out of that, I believe the sponsor drafted an amendment which has been distributed to members. Ms. Perman, would you be able to present and speak on the amendment at hand?
To the chair, yes. For the record, my name is Sarah Perman. We have provided you with an amendment to House Bill 20 that adds in, this is in regards to our concerns about whether it's a duty or not. This adds in language, says, nothing in this paragraph requires or obligates an individual holding an elective public office in the state to solemnize a marriage. So this alleviates any concerns that you feel obligated or have a duty to marry anyone, solemnize a marriage.
Are there questions for Ms. Perman on the amendment?
I'd also like to know, Representative Clayman is on the line, if there's any other questions.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Perman. That's a very good point. And welcome telephonically, Representative Clayman, and thank you for being available. Any questions for Representative Clayman or Ms. Perman on Amendment Number 1, A.1, for the record? At this time, I'd entertain a motion to move Amendment Number 1, A.1, from any member of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 20, version 30/LS0242, /A, with as amended, and looks like 0 fiscal notes.
Quick at ease. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move Amendment Number 1.
Is there any objection from the committee? Hearing no objection, Amendment Number 1 A.1 is adopted. And with amendment number 1 adopted, we'll move on to discussion and debate. Are there any perspectives from committee members on the merits of House Bill 20 before we look to move this bill from committee? Representative Birch.
I'm going to be a no vote. I think we've got a lot of issues in front of us, and this is solving a problem that, I mean, you can basically go down and buy a license for $25. Anybody in the state can, and I don't see it as a necessary piece of legislation. Thank you.
Further discussion. See none, and thank you, Representative Birch, for those comments. Is there a motion for House Bill 20?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I move to move House Bill 20 out of committee, version 30-LS0242/A, as amended, with attached zero fiscal notes.
Is there any objection?
Just one.
Representative Birch, you have an objection. Would you like to speak to your objection?
I just did. Thank you.
All right. Will the clerk please call a roll?
Representative Knapp?
Yes.
Representative Wold? Representative Kopp? Representative Ledoux? Representative Birch?
No.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Kapp?
Yes.
Representative Josephson?
Yes.
Chair Christ Tompkins?
Yes.
4 yeas, 2 nays.
Thank you. And with a vote of 4 yeas and 2 nays, House Bill 20 moves from committee. And as an administrative note, I'm going to save all the paperwork for the end on bills that move from committee today. So we will roll right along. Thank you so much, Ms. Perman, for being available.
To the chair, thank you.
And thank you, Representative Clayman, for calling in. Next on the agenda is House Concurrent Resolution 5. Come again, Representative Bridge.
Representative Clayman, did he vote?
No, and he's not on the committee.
He just presented.
Oh, I see. Okay, I got you. Thanks.
Thank you.
Next is House Concurrent Resolution 5, sponsored by Representative Eastman. And if Representative Eastman and Mr. McClure would be available to come to the front of the room. This is the second hearing on this piece of legislation. Public testimony was advertised on Thursday, and I erred in failing to open public testimony, and we did have someone online who I spoke with later that night to make apologies to. And given that public testimony was advertised on Thursday and did not happen, I'm going to reopen public testimony on House Concurrent Resolution 5 at this time. And I'm seeing no one online and looking in the back of the room and seeing a shaking head. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify on House Concurrent Resolution 5? Seeing no one coming forward, I'm going to close House Concurrent Resolution 5. Although, rest assured, Representative Eastman, you have a strong supporter, and Mr. Ed Martin, who I spoke with, so that was individualized public testimony. I believe he's gotten Representative Knopf's here at one point in time as well. So with public testimony closed, we're going to move forward, and I believe there's an amendment on the table that Representative Knopf spoke to earlier. And Representative Knopf, would you be willing to move your amendment?
I would move amendment number 1. Version 30-LS0359/A.1.
Is there any objection?
Committee.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. Representative Knopf, would you be able to speak to your amendment?
You know,
thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment, I struggled with the need for the amendment, and it was brought to me by another House member who reviewed the resolution and asked me to insert that to specifically say that the Committee on Committees is subject to the proportional rule, as is in every other standing committee. And so we run the proposed amendment by Legislative Legal, who conferred that it should be inserted. And I spoke with him at length yesterday, trying to understand. He said, put them side by side and read it, and I did, and it was starting to make a little bit of sense to me. So I move the amendment. I think even if it does not make sense to a lot of members, it does no harm by having that verbiage in there. So.
And I should note, Doug Gerner from Legislative Legal is online to take questions on this amendment. Are there any questions from committee members? I'll go for it, Mr. Gardner. If you can hear, could you speak to the merit you might see in Amendment Number One on the table?
Thank you, Representative Christ Tompkins. For the record, Doug Gardner, Director of Legal Services. My understanding is that that the goal of this piece of legislation is to make uniform Rule 1E conform to recent practices by the legislature and primarily the House. I believe you have some information there in front of you that identifies the recent trends. When I looked at how uniform Rule 1E has been utilized by the House in the last 10 years or so, generally speaking, even though the rule provides for the speaker to select five members to serve on the Committee on Committees, generally speaking, I think I'm making a broad statement, but I think that it's generally been five majority members and two minority members. There have been some deviations from that, but that's my general recollection of looking at basis in the last few years. And so my understanding is that the goal is to try and conform the language of the rule to the actual practice of the House. Now, so if the practice is identified as putting seven members on the committee, then the amendment that Representative Knopp has asked that I prepare does that with certainty. It nails down that there are going to be seven members on this committee. And the other thing that the amendment does is the amendment, right now the Committee on Committees is not a standing committee, and so there isn't proportional representation. When you look at Uniform Rule 1E and you look at the grid that identifies how many minority members are on each committee, depending on the size of the minority, those grids just simply don't apply to the Committee on Committees.
And Mr. Gardner, I'm really sorry to interrupt you. I believe Mr. Knopf has a comment on the amendment that may help clarify where we're at.
Mr. Gardner, Gary Knopf here. So after we spoke yesterday, we somewhat modified that amendment you had drafted for us. We deleted the five and left that language alone, or the seven. We just left that at least five in the original resolution. So I only moved the bottom line, I think line 12, Committee on Committees, insertion of that verbiage. We talked about that conceptually, and I didn't get back to you this morning to let you know I had done that. So,
okay, well then that does make it simpler. So if that's true, and the proposal in front of the committee is to just leave the five membership alone, and have the Committee on Committees be subject to the proportional representation, then the number of minority members that will be on the committee and committee simply depends on the size of the minority, and it provides certainty as to how many members would be on there. Representative Knopf, does your amendment leave the language of the resolution at least five alone? Does it change that at all?
No, sir, it does not. It leaves it alone.
So that would mean, through the chair, members, that would mean that if the speaker chose to populate the committee with seven members, then you would simply go to the grid and look at seven, figure out how many minority members would be on the committee, and it would provide certainty in terms of the proportion. It doesn't provide any certainty in terms of the number of members, so I suppose you could have five, at least five. You could have seven. I suppose you could have nine. But if flexibility is what the committee wants, then this resolution and the HCR 5 together would do that. But it does provide certainty with respect to the membership in terms of the proportion once the number of members in the committee are identified. I know it's a mouthful, but that's all I have right now, Representative Christ-Tonkins.
Thank you. And Mr. Gardner has a question from Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gardner, so having that language put in where it's at, if there was less than 25% minority status, then that means that the majority would not have to recognize anyone to be on the committee from the minority. The majority doesn't have to recognize anyone from the minority for committee on committees. Is that correct?
That's correct. Once the size of the minority in the House in any given year drops below 10, then it's not a legally cognizable minority, and so therefore there wouldn't be any membership on the committee on committees.
Follow-up?
A comment. So, committee on committees is such an important committee because we are establishing all other committees and the memberships of those other committees. Traditionally, I think we've had, a minimum of two for quite a while, and I don't know how far that may go back. I don't know if it was ever less than that. I like this amendment because it does follow the structure for anything other than five or more than five, and it stays with consistent as how we have our other committee makeups. However, if we do have a small minority, a very small minority to where it's less than eight people in the House or eight or less, I would like to have some sort of minimum provision so that it's just not all majority members and there's no voice, because that's the only opportunity that the minority will have a voice in that situation. So I do like this amendment. I think it's appropriate where it's placed, but I would like to somehow add in a minimum of two. I'm just going to look it up real quick.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Tuck. Any other questions from the committee for Mr. Gardner or the sponsor of Amendment Number 1? Seeing none, at this time I'm going to withdraw my objection. Is there any further objection from members of the committee for Amendment Number 1 from Representative Knopf? Hearing no objection, Amendment Number 1 is adopted, and that brings us back to the bill. Are there any questions for the sponsor?
For members of the committee? If I may, Mr.
Yes.
Chair, if we can just take just a quick moment so I can propose an additional amendment, if the bill sponsor is okay with having a minimum minority regardless of amount of membership.
Representative Eastman.
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, I think you raise a very valid point. We did some research going back to 1975 in terms of minority representation in both the House and the Senate. And some may remember that there are times when in the Senate the minority caucus has had fewer than 25% membership and so is not officially a recognized caucus. And in a number of those situations, the presiding officer determined that they would include minority representation on that committee, even though rules did not require that they do so. A concern, depending on how the amendment would be worded, is that by requiring the Committee on Committees to follow the same prescription as the standing committees, you might actually remove that flexibility for the presiding officer. If there is no minority caucus, an argument can be made that the presiding officer would then not have the opportunity to recognize them. He would be required, or she would be required, to only recognize members of the majority caucus. So I think that would be a concern that I would have as a sponsor, that we don't inadvertently keep the minority from being represented on that committee. And I think that's just a question of making sure that the wording is appropriate. But I certainly don't have any objection to the intent of that amendment.
Representative Tuck, any further comment, or would a brief at ease be?
Just a brief at ease, because sure. I think I know where to put it. Just one
we'll
second.
We'll go off the record for a moment. On the record, Representative Tuck, I believe you're contemplating the possibility of an amendment. Any Any conclusions there?
Yes. Unfortunately, to be able to put in a minority member requirement to the Committee on Committees would have to mean that you have to recognize a minority to be able to do that, and less than 25% doesn't recognize a minority. So I don't know how you would craft language to allow a member, maybe a member other than the majority, is the way to phrase that. But I'll work on it with the bill sponsor in the next committee.
All right, that sounds good, Representative Tuck. And I believe the sponsor is a member of the next committee, so sounds like there'll be ample opportunity. Any further discussion on House Concurrent Resolution 5 as amended? Seeing none, I would entertain a motion to move this concurrent resolution from committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move HCR 5 as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. And that's version 30-LS0359/A.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, House Concurrent Resolution 5 as amended, attached zero fiscal notes, moves from committee. And once again, we won't take an out of use to sign the paperwork. We'll do it at the end. And that takes us to the next item on today's agenda. Thank you, Representative Eastman. The next item on today's agenda is House Bill 44 relating to conflict of interest and legislative ethics. This is the first hearing for this bill and the second committee of referral. Sponsor is Representative Gren, and I see Mr. Johnson, staff to Representative Gren, the room as well. Please come up and present the bill. And I think on a process-based note, the intention today is to make an introduction of the piece of legislation, perhaps a few questions, but generally a sort of light first hearing, and we can kind of let it settle in for a few days and also have the opportunity to sidebar with a sponsor for points of interest. And we'll take this up in greater depth on Tuesday. Representative Gren, welcome, and please present the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I am Representative Jason Gren, representing District 22 in West Anchorage, and I appreciate the opportunity to present this piece of legislation. Before I get started, I would like to notify members that Jerry Anderson, the committee administrator of Legislative Ethics Committee, and Dan Wayne, the drafter of the bill, are joining us on the line today and will be available to answer any questions if needed. The intent of House Bill 44 is to increase transparency within the legislature and allow the public to see with utmost certainty that conflicts of interest are taken seriously in Alaska. The intent of this bill is not to stop a legislator from voting on an issue. We are elected officials sent here to represent our constituents. But the language in this bill does not, and the language in this bill does not directly stop a legislator from voting or ever outright disqualify them. The bill simply lays out a standard form from which a legislator can decide for themselves if they have a substantial conflict of interest. There's always room for improvement, and I believe that the legislator can exemplify a higher standard. HB 44 contains provisions to ensure conflicts are substantial before a legislator would be required to abstain from voting. Any benefit a legislator or a member of the legislator's immediate family that might receive from supporting or opposing a particular piece of legislation that would have a greater than the benefit of a large group of Alaskans would receive due to the legislation in order to require abstention. The bill recognizes the responsibility of legislators to vote, except in clear cases where the outcome of the vote would result in a substantial personal financial gain. This includes cases where an immediate family member or a legislator's employer would receive a large and direct financial benefit. I will now defer to my staff, Ryan Johnson, to walk members through the bill.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ryan Johnston, staff to Representative Jason Gren, House District 22. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 44. I'll begin with a sectional analysis on HB 44. HB 44 has, version U has six sections. Section 1 outlines the conflict of interest standards from which a legislator may determine if they have a conflict of interest on a particular issue. Conflict is defined as a substantial benefit or harm to the financial interest of the legislator's immediate family, the legislator's employer, an immediate family member's employer, a person from whom the legislator is negotiating employment, or from whom the legislator or immediate family member has received more than $10,000 in income within the last 12 months. Exceptions to this include those outlined in Section 2. Section 2 outlines that a legislator may vote on a question in a committee after declaring a conflict of interest and must request to abstain from voting on the floor if the legislator or an immediate family member has a substantial financial interest. A legislator may vote on an appropriation bill that meets the requirements in the appropriation statutes AS-3707-020A or AS-3707-100. Section 3 defines substantially benefit or harm as the effect on the person's financial interest being greater than the effect on the financial interest of a substantial class of persons to which the legislator belongs as a member of a profession, occupation, industry, or region. Section 4 defines financial interest as ownership of an interest or involvement in a business, property ownership, or relationship that is a source of income or financial benefit. Section 5 provides that this act only takes effect upon passage of House Concurrent Resolution 1, amending Uniform Rules 34B. Finally, Section 6 provides for an effective date later than that of the resolution to Uniform Rule 34B referred to in Section 5. Version U, as you can see, is the committee substitute from the House Judiciary Committee. The major change made from the Judiciary Committee is found on page 2, line 21 of the Version U. The change cleaned up language about the committee process and changed the language to require a legislator to simply declare the conflict in a committee before voting on a bill instead of not being able to vote in committee. So it just cleaned up that process in committee. I would like to quickly provide for you an example of a possible situation where there would be a substantial interest conflict of interest for a legislator. There's a legislator who votes on major roads in the interior, and that legislator themselves is part of the substantial class of persons who live on an interior road or in the interior. If a legislator votes on a bill affecting a road that only accesses a parcel of land of which the legislator is the sole owner, then the legislator has a substantial interest in that bill, which is different or greater than anyone else who lives in the interior that could benefit from a road to their house as well. And under AS-2460-030 Section G, they would be required to request an abstention. This example can be found in your bill packet in the Legislative Research Report 15.422 with the advisory opinion 2004-02 on page 6. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this concludes my prepared testimony. Thank you for the opportunity, and we welcome any questions from the committee at this time.
Thank you, Representative Johnson, and I already see a few questions. A quick note, House Concurrent Resolution number 1 was not noticed for today, but that will be on Tuesday's agenda. So these sort of twin pieces of legislation will be heard next week at the next hearing. Also would like to recognize and welcome Representative Pruitt and Millett for being here this morning and spending their Saturday in the most glorious possible way. Welcome. And I believe a question from Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I reviewed this and corresponded with a number of folks, constituents, and others. What do you view as the voter's role? I would say to the sponsor in evaluating the qualifications, merits, and business, if you will, of the respective candidate and then House member. And I say that because basically everybody in this building has run for office. Every representative, 40 House members actually run every 2 years. So every one of us just got wrapped up in an election. Half of the Senate runs every 2 years. And so I struggle with kind of setting aside the voters, if you will, in the context here. And I would appreciate some sort of insight, because generally speaking, the opponent, and through our election process, the opposition through the election process very aptly and capably illustrates whatever affiliations and financial interests that a candidate has. But I would just be interested in kind of your perspective on where the voters weigh in on this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Birch, are you asking how voters weigh in during a campaign process,
in other words, the voters understand where somebody's employed or not employed. Whether you're a business agent for a union, or you're a doctor, or you're an engineer, or you're a retail person, or you work for a large multinational corporation. whatever you're, whatever you do, notwithstanding the fact that everybody, as you, as we all know, has to find basically on an annual basis, do a POFD. It's a personal, public offices financial disclosure. So basically, you have to lay all your laundry out, if you will, in front of the public as to where all your financial interests lie. But the part that concerns me about this is that we do have an election process every 2 years, where if the public is validly and reasonably concerned, as illustrated by an opponent, the issues are out there. And I guess I'm just wondering, I'm concerned about disenfranchising the 17,000 people that each of us represent in our election district.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, I think this is also focused on unanticipated legislation. Like my staff, Ryan Johnson, mentioned, if you own property and, that's not made known to the voters, or it's not something that's talked about, or your opponent talks about, and no one really brings that to light. But if you own a property, now the state is going to go through that property and make you a millionaire. Is that something that might be reflected in a future campaign, perhaps? Is it something that you should declare as a conflict of interest, perhaps? And what we're saying through this legislation is giving some guidelines about what a substantial financial interest means through bills that you might be voting on, and then allowing that to go through a different process than is now. And so it creates more transparency. It's another layer that voters can become aware of those financial conflicts. Not to say that there was anything hidden beforehand, but as we go through a process with new legislation, that they're kept aware of any potential conflict of interests.
Yeah.
Follow up, Representative.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but I, as far as your illustration, I suspect if any member of this body was to be on the receiving end of $1 million benefit from as a result of legislation, I'm cautiously optimistic that the media and the public and those critical that would bring that to bear. But one of the most substantial issues we're dealing right now is a $3 billion budget deficit. We each have a substantial interest in resolving that and kind of diving into that. And that's going to affect each and every one of us differently. But all that being said, I think that our duty and obligation is to our individual voters, that I'm concerned that we're going to get something that's kind of a little muddled around the edges about your idea of substantial and my idea of substantial might differ, and I'm concerned that we're going to leave our constituency, if you will, we're going to abandon them with the challenges that may rise up on whether somebody's qualified to vote on an issue because of a real or perceived conflict. And I think members do have an opportunity to voice their concern about if they have they can announce that conflict on the floor. But anyway, I don't mean to dominate this, but I do have a concern about disenfranchising the voters that we are, each of us are elected every 2 years to represent.
Please, if I may, through the chair, Representative Birch. Again, this only allows an opportunity to speak to your conflict. You then, we're suggesting that, as opposed to what happens now with just a lone objection that's not on the record, you're now allowing your body to hear out your conflict and allow your colleagues to vote if you should be abstained or not from voting. So there is a process to it, and you would never, some states, there are some states, if you have a conflict, you're out. Your vote, you're not allowed to vote. There are some states who treat it that serious. We didn't go that far in our proposal. We do feel that we do want to have a public process to it and allow for our colleagues to vote about our potential conflicts.
Okay. And lastly, is there any particular genesis for this? Or, did you come across something that you found was so egregious that it compelled you to introduce this?
Through the chair, in our particular building, not at all. Okay. I've spoken several times before I ran for office. I was asked to resign from my job because of a potential conflict of interest. I did so because I didn't want my campaign to be having any sort of conflict of interest attached to it. But I believe you know, 49 other states do it differently. They allow their voters to kind of see their legislators as transparent as possible, and I believe that we can always move towards improving, building trust with the voters, and I believe this legislation helps do that.
Well, I would say, as one person, I was just going to say it's unfortunate that you resigned your job, because I think we do have a citizen legislature here, and hopefully every one of us has another life outside the purportedly 3 months that we spend down here in Juneau. Thank you.
Thanks, Representative Bridge, for those comments, and we'll have ample opportunity for further questions and discussion next week. And I see a couple more questions from Representative Knopf. Did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I may have two questions, but I'm going to direct this one to your staff, Mr. Grant. So my concern about the ethics legislation is that we're going to muddy everything up in chambers, and everybody's going to stand up and declare a conflict, erring on the side of caution. So in a hypothetical, so say we got a capital budget bill in front of us that's going to fund a bunch of interior roads, and a member is a voting member is a construction contractor, and although it is going to go out the public bid process, and it's all public, and everything on the floor is public knowledge, public process, there is a scenario where is a contractor who may or may not bid on the project got a conflict of interest, and is that the road we're going to go down on every single time we have something coming up here? That's my question.
Ryan Johnston, staff to Representative Gren, through the chair, Representative Knopf. So if it came to a final budget vote per se, technically with the language in the bill, every legislator is required to vote on the final budget under AS 3707-020A. So in that situation, hypothetically, from our understanding, is that legislator could stand and declare their conflict again if they wanted to, but the chair would declare them out of order. Their conflict of interest would go on the record, but it wouldn't then go to the vote from the body, and unlike the other situation if it was not a budgetary vote.
Follow up, Representative Knopf.
Thank you. Yeah, and I probably used a bad scenario there, since statute requires you to vote on the budget bill. So, but not statutorily required to vote, but any other issue. So, yeah, you're getting the drift of my
yes.
concern. And so I want to address this next question to Representative Gren, and it's kind of touching on what Representative Birch asked you. So in the current process we have, even in your campaign, there must have been something in there that had you focused on this, and I'm kind of looking for what that was. What do we currently do that does not declare our conflicts, or why does it need to be more thorough, I guess? Is there something that you can recall that triggered this for you?
Through the chair, Representative Knopf, from a personal anecdote, no, there isn't. You know, again, we wrote this, we drafted this proposal outside of any other discussions with other members or other people in this building or outside of this building. We were my office worked on this individually and solely focused on creating transparency, adding something to the layer that the public can trust what we're doing when there's a feeling or a perceived feeling of a conflict of interest. You know, as mentioned, there's nothing that's happened recently, I'll say, in the building, several years at least, from an outside perspective, from what I've been watching, that made me jump up to put this forward. But as I went door to door, speaking of campaigns, talking with my constituents, people who felt that, to be frank, someone used the word tarmac disease, said when legislators hit the tarmac, they didn't know everything that was happening, and they felt their legislators were doing that their voters a disservice by not being more open and transparent. And I heard that a lot, that people were wanting to find ways to know exactly you know, what was happening in Juneau. And I explained, you know, there's cameras everywhere, there's social media, there's documents that we fill out, and I think we do a very good job of trying to share everything we do. But in an age of ease and access, I think anything we can do to put more on the record, put it on the public record, I believe we should, and this legislation does that.
And final follow-up, Representative Gren.
Good, thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Mr. Gren, I mean, Representative Gren, I'm intrigued by this, and the fact that other states do it tells me it must have some credibility. But the one thing, and I'm sure this has been brought to your attention or was vetted in judiciary, that gives me a little bit of concern is the following sort of set of circumstances. And I'll preface it by saying something that I don't mean to offend anybody, but this building is a remarkably partisan building. Now, is it always partisan? No, thankfully. But it's very, very partisan. And if the public was aware of how partisan it is, I think they'd be shocked. But I'm going to use an example to depersonalize it of another state. In the state of Hawaii, there are 25 senators. Currently, all 25 are members of the Democratic Party. That is a fact, which is sort of amazing to me. 2 years ago, 24 of them were Democrats, and one was Republican. What would happen in a situation in Hawaii if the Republican, again a hypothetical, was a pineapple grower and had a pineapple farm on the north shore of Oahu, and a Democrat had a pineapple bill and wanted a unanimous vote, but for whatever reason was concerned the Republican had a conflict and would vote against his pineapple bill? Wouldn't the 24 Democrats gang up, and when the conflict was declared by the Republican, make a finding that in fact it was substantial and that he must be recused from voting? That's sort of the concern I have, that the minority, whoever's in the minority, will not get the same objective hearing on a conflict debate. How do you resolve that?
Ryan Johnston, staff to Representative Grant. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, a long answer would be that there are many steps leading up to a legislator needing to stand on the floor and recuse himself. Because one point I'd like to make is the bill is not changing that fact by any means. This is left to the legislator to stand on the floor and make their own declaration of a conflict and request to abstain. This isn't saying that someone can then stand on the floor and declare or call someone out. It's really pointing at that issue of when you stand and declare. But backing up, that single minority member could go to the Ledge Ethics Committee and go, hey, I'd like an advisory opinion on this prior to even having to stand. And then so if the Ethics Committee came back and said, you know, you don't have a substantial conflict, here's an advisory opinion for you, then it would save them having to stand and declare. And then if by some way the majority members tried to file an ethics complaint, that lone minority member could, well, I have this advisory opinion, and this is why I did it this way. And so there are checks and balances. There isn't a supermajority control of this. There are checks and balances to it, and I think it provides avenues for legislators to get opinions. It's not you're left on the floor on the fly to do this. There, you can have Ledge Ethics and Ledge Legal provide you with advisory opinions, and you can determine if you really have that substantial conflict for yourself before declaring. So I don't know if that answers your question fully, but
It helps. Thank you.
Any follow-up, Representative Josephson?
No, thank you.
And any questions? Representative Johnson, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I just was maybe going back to the representative from Anchorage and his concern, and I just wanted to propose a scenario and just to ask you how you see this. Maybe the pineapple farm, we don't quite have one here in Alaska, but something similar. So you have a district that has all farmers, pineapple farmers, see? And so, of course, they elect a pineapple farmer because that's what is going to be representational of that district. Now, that means every time a pineapple bill comes before the legislature, they are not going to, they're going to declare a conflict and may not be able to vote on it. And so in essence, that takes that district, their main concern is the biggest concern they have, and that's why they have that representation, and that's what they cannot now are going to have the least representation on. So how do you see that? I mean,
Ryan Johnson, staff for Representative Gren. Through the chair, Representative Johnson. So with the language that is in the bill, simply being a pineapple farmer and a pineapple bill coming up does not mean that you have a conflict. It's more to looking to what's in the bill. And if there's a tax for all pineapple farmers that's the same across the board and that's all that the bill does, then we would say no, that legislator has every right to vote on that bill at the time. It's affecting his entire class of persons, industry, or region the same. But let's say that same pineapple bill is introduced and all it does is gives tax incentive for pineapple farms over 1,000 acres, and that legislator owns the only pineapple farm above 1,000 acres, to us that would then kick in and go, you do have a substantial conflict and you should stand and declare that. But it's by simply being a part of an industry, this bill does not say that you outright have a conflict of interest. There must be something has to set you apart from the rest of your group, that you are the one that is only benefiting or being harmed by that situation to declare or to enact a conflict of interest.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my concern is that, you know, in an attempt to err on the side of caution, I think most people are going to over-declare, or also, and there's the whole other piece of not wanting to vote on controversial legislation because that they just don't want to, and wanting to be conflicted out. That's kind of my biggest concern on this legislation.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. And Representative Tuck, not that you're obligated, but any questions for the bill sponsor?
Everybody go around? I guess it's my turn. Well, I just, no questions, but I'll just state that it seems pretty innocent to me, this bill, because what it's doing is, you know, the reason why we have conflict of interest in declaring that is to allow a person to not have to vote on a piece of legislation that they may personally benefit from. And however, all it takes is one person to override that in the legislature by saying object. And so then that person is required to vote on that piece of legislation. And so I think it's appropriate that instead of one person being able to object, that the full body decides on whether or not a person shall vote or not. It's actually protection for for all of us as individual members, because there are times when a vote may hurt your political career. There's a time when a vote may hurt your private career, your private interest, and if you're voting against the industry that you're if you're voting against, say for example, you have a nail salon, and a piece of legislation benefits that particular nail salon because they're the only ones that can handle the training and nobody else, and you're part owner of that nail salon, then sure, you might be voting on behalf of the industry, but there's only one person that can provide the services, then should that person be able to benefit, and should that person be able to vote on that piece of legislation? And so so I think it's a pretty innocent bill. I think it's just rather than one person being able to force a vote from someone, that it's a decision of the full body.
All right. Well, we've done a full ring around the rosy. Also, I'd like to welcome and recognize Representative Kawasaki. I'd say, Representative Green, you're a very popular legislator this morning, or at least this bill is. And I think we'll hold this bill for now. And obviously, there's some thoughts and, you know, serious considerations with this. And at future hearings, we'll both open public testimony as well as take amendments. And, of course, would encourage you to confer with a sponsor on the latter if you're inspired. But thank you, Representative Gren and Mr. Johnson, for taking the time to present this morning. And moving on to the last item on today's agenda, in honor of our erstwhile member, Representative Josephson, a member of State Affairs and alternate State Affairs, and we have House Bill 13 relating to state and municipal funds for immigrant registry. And public testimony has been noticed and will be opened today for this piece of legislation. But first, there's a proposed committee substitute. And Vice Chair Tuck, is there a motion for adoption?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that the House State Affairs Committee adopt
Committee Substitute 30-LS0147/J as the working document.
Is there any objection? Hearing no objection, the committee substitute has been adopted as our working document. And with the committee substitute in front of us, Representative Josephson, excuse me, and staff, if you would mind, please present the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Andy Josephson, for the record. Sitting with me is my aide, Paul Kelly, who's been helping me on this bill. I would like to begin the presentation by first reading a couple things into the record that I think set the historical context for my introducing this bill, if I may.
Please, Representative Josephson.
And then I'll talk about the more sort of recent context. When I was at the local synagogue 8 days ago, I went partly because of my faith, but I went partly because it was the yard site for the late Representative Max Gruenberg, for whom this room is named. A yard site is an annual commemoration of a person's death. And at the service on that Friday night, which was 8 days ago, a visiting rabbinical student read the following, and most of you will recognize this. If I may, it comes from Pastor Martin Niemöller, who wrote the following in response to his witnessing the Holocaust. He said, "First they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me." That's a very well-known sort of writing. And it's been updated by a Rabbi Michael Adam, and this is what we heard at the synagogue for Max Gruenberg's yard site. "First they came for the African Americans, and I spoke up because I am my sisters and brothers' keeper. And then they came for the women, and I spoke up because women hold up half the sky. And then they came for the immigrants, and I spoke up because I remember the ideals of our democracy. And then they came for the Muslims, and I spoke up because they are my cousins and we are one family. And then they came for the Native Americans and Mother Earth, and I spoke up because the blood-soaked land cries and the mountains weep. They keep coming, we keep rising up." I thought that was a remarkably sort of apropos commentary brought to us at that service 2 Fridays ago by the rabbinical student, and very relevant to why I presented this bill. And now, if I may, I'd like to read from a U.S. Supreme Court decision, which is still the law of the land, albeit very, very strongly disfavored. May I do that?
Briefly, Representative Josephson.
This is from a dissenting opinion, and we'll talk about the opinion. "I dissent, therefore, from this legalization of racism. Racial discrimination in any form and in any degree has no justifiable part whatever in our democratic way of life. It is unattractive in any setting, but it is utterly revolting among a free people who have embraced the principles set forth in the Constitution. All residents of this nation are kin in some way by blood or culture to a foreign land, yet they are primarily and necessarily a part of the new and distinct civilization of the United States. They must accordingly be treated at all times as the heirs of the American experiment and as entitled to all the rights and freedoms granted by the Constitution." And there are three like dissenting statements. These are dissents from former Justice Murphy, Roberts, a different Roberts, and Jackson in the Korematsu decision. And that is the decision where the Supreme Court in 1944, by a remarkable vote of 6-3, said it was okay to randomly and arbitrarily gather up every Japanese American and put them in a concentration camp. Now, you may ask...
And Representative, yes, I'm not sure if you meant to say concentration camp.
I did. That's okay. What they were called. An internment camp was also the term.
Okay.
You may ask, well, what is the relevance of this? The current president has indicated to the press, both before his election, immediately after his election, and his Secretary of State said this just last month, that the federal government is considering a registry of certain people based on religion. Now, I want to be clear, this is a different comment than, this is really not, although certainly they overlap, a discussion of the immigration order, which has been enjoined by at least one appellate court. This is about, according to what's been written and spoken, this is about a registry of people who are nationalized or born Americans presently. They're not traveling Americans. They're not traveling tourists. They're just Americans. And the administration has indicated a desire to, or consideration of registering them. And the reason I read the Korematsu decision is I believe in critical moments like this, it's important to, as I say, document and mark the history. And for future generations and the present generation to know that the legislature saw this happening and took a stand. And it's very much, and this should have been distributed by your aide, it's very much like the 2003 resolution that passed both bodies as Legislative Resolve 27. It was, for the record, SCS, CSHJR 22 Judiciary. This was a statement of the legislature about the Patriot Act. And incidentally, it was co-sponsored by some of the most conservative members of the legislature in the last 20 years, including, I mean, widely regarded, Senator Dyson, Senator Secon, Senator Taylor, Senator Terrio, Senator Ogun, and Senator Cowdery, and also then Representative John Coghill. And I encourage you to look at page 2 of it, but basically there are some key parts of it where it says that the state and its instrumentalities, its local governments, is not going to be involved in using state resources or institutions for the enforcement of federal immigration matters. Now, I contemplated in my bill, which we'll talk about, I promise, I contemplated similar language, but my bill, frankly, doesn't go that far. My bill is about registries. And if you look, for example, at page 2, 26 lines 26 to 28, and really throughout the resolves, you will see that this resolution, just 18 months after 9/11, is a statement about Alaskans' belief in liberty, and that we're not going to, even though the country was in trauma, much more so then than I think now, there's a lot of division now, but less imminent threat and less fear of being under imminent threat. I think that's a reasonably fair statement. That the legislature did the right thing and said, we're going to protect individual liberties. So what I've done in this legislation is I have simply said that the state and its instrumentalities, its local governments, are not going to use assets which are described in Title 44, basically personnel and treasure, to support any national effort, federal overreach effort, to create a registry based on race, religion, ethnicity, or national origin. I won't be too terribly much longer, but basically, you know, my view of this is the drafters, of course I was the author, but the drafters in the Terry Miller Building properly selected, and I think this is noteworthy, they selected 4490-040, which is on miscellaneous state matters. In fact, it refers to miscellaneous provisions. And above it, in this list of things where the state government, that is we, through Title 44, is saying we're not going to participate, is a prohibition on essentially enforcing federal laws on our Second Amendment privileges. Or anything that would violate the due process of Alaska citizens generally. And so I think this properly fits in that family of prohibitions and preclusions. And, you know, fundamentally, Again, the reason I read Korematsu or some of the dissent, I could read more if you'd like. I'd be happy to. And that I reference essentially these poems, for lack of a better word, from religious scholars, is that I want future generations, when they're writing dissertations 100 years from now, if there is a registry, I want a statement of fact, a statement of history that says this legislature caught that moment, and before we participated in something that we regretted, like our treatment of American Indians historically, our treatment of Japanese Americans, and of course African Americans, that we caught ourselves, and noteworthy, we caught ourselves not at a time of great stress like right after 9/11, but 15, 16 years later when we could calmly say, this is government overreach. And I would be happy if there's any belief that no, in fact, there's no need for this, I would be happy to cite to media reports of what the president and most recently Secretary Tillerson have said, that indeed they would look at a registry of, for example, minority religion members. So that was the reason for my filing this.
Thank you, Representative.
Yes.
Yeah. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Birch.
Well, I can appreciate thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can appreciate some of the hysteria that is kind of pushed this forward, but I guess my question would be, to the extent that we already have a resolution that reasonably and appropriately lays out, extending from back to 2003, the standing, if you will, and the position of the state legislature, I guess I'm wondering why do we need this if we have what was handed out here earlier in 2003? And I say that just because I certainly agree conceptually with what's here. Although I have to say I wonder when the federal government's doing a census, I know they go through and ask everybody, I don't know how that fits into this, but the government does collect information from everybody in the country on every 10 years, but isn't this redundant if we have this?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, I think it's not redundant, and the reason is that resolution is a reflection of the legislature in 2003 and 2004 and not the present legislature. So that would be the short answer. Mm-hmm. And again, I think that this is the first time in my lifetime, because I wasn't alive in 1944, as you can see. Hopefully you can still see. Hopefully I haven't aged that much in this job. But this is the first time in my lifetime where an executive officer of the government at the highest level has said, and his Secretary of State has said, yeah, we're thinking about registering people. It's worthwhile to say the state of Alaska, as a matter of law, won't be participating. If the federal government wants to do it, that's up to the federal government. And we're not going to commit any muscle to that effort.
But follow up. Have you gotten any indication whatsoever that the governor or any, functionality of the state is a municipality or otherwise is contemplating this at any level?
Well,
state.
I think the short answer is no. But I would also say that we saw legislation passed saying that we wouldn't participate in the enforcement of federal gun laws, and there was no evidence that the state was going to directly enforce those federal gun laws, which never came anyway. I think there's nothing wrong with doing something prophylactic now, and I also don't know the capacity, frankly, because it's a very complicated question, of the federal government to compel that sort of deputizing. I think it may exist.
And also, if you'll through the chair, Paul Kelly, staff representative Josephson. I think also that's the reason why we included the Korematsu in this bill packet is he had to go all the way to the Supreme Court. It took him 2.5 years. In the end, he got ruled against. But if we cut this off before it starts, then there's no need for a judicial remedy and for somebody to have to wait 2.5 years for justice.
Follow-up. Okay. Other questions from the other side of the committee? Representative Knott, please.
Thank you, and I won't drag this off. And I'm not sure you need to answer this question, but you feel free if you so need. So it prohibits the expenditure of state or municipal assets to create a registry, as you stated, but as you know, federal overreach all comes with federal dollars. So my question really is, it doesn't actually prevent the registry, it just prevents the state from participating with state assets. So the question is, the federal could still come in, set up office, create the registry, and do it in the state, number one. And then number two, what if they just funneled federal dollars into the state for this? Would that still be considered state assets? And I just throw that out there as a question. Because you're trying to prevent the registry from happening, but specifically you're preventing the state from participating in that registry.
Through the chair, Representative Knopf, that's correct. It refers pretty plainly to state or municipal agencies and the use of their power and treasure. And I don't know. I mean, you know, one thing, by the way, that I think is quite relevant when we look at Korematsu, and I really want to emphasize this, is the Supreme Court ultimately, and you know, many people think President Roosevelt was one of our better presidents. I share that feeling. But this is a very large stain on his record. And what I was going to say is that the Supreme Court has said, in fact, there's a commentary from Justice Scalia where he said, yeah, this was clearly a wrong decision, but he's not convinced that the courts ultimately would stop it. In fact, for example, this immigration order, and I don't want to sort of get into that, but what you might find is the president's power when it comes to the borders is at its greatest, and the Supreme Courts usually defer on defensive sort of security measures to the executive branch very extensively, and that's what they did in Korematsu. But what's offensive about what's being said and proposed by the administration, both before the election, after the election, and after the inauguration, is what's being contemplated is not just the borders, it's people presently living here carrying American passports. And to me, it's just, I think we would do ourselves well by saying, we caught you, and we Alaskans believe in our liberty, and we're not going to participate in this. And if this helps, by the way, the statute 4499.100B says asset means funds, facilities, equipment, services, or other resources of a state or municipal agency. So all those nouns, funds, facilities, equipment, services, we're not going to touch that. And we're not going to let the municipality of Anchorage or the city and borough of Juneau touch that because they're creatures of ours and we can dictate that they don't do that. And if you, the federal government, want to set up an office and do a, quote, Korematsu, close quote, it's not because we're helping.
And quickly, on the other side of the room, Representative Johnson, Representative Tuck, any questions?
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
And, this is Representative Tuck, that that's kind of like the Transportation Security Agency. There's nothing we can do. We pass resolutions out of this body opposing the procedures and the invasive actions of the TSA, but there's nothing we can do about stopping them from setting up shop in our airports. But what we can do is prevent our museums, our ferry systems, and everything else, unless there's some sort of federal mandate that they're able to get on our ferry systems, but allows us to be able to prevent from those type of activities on our state-owned facilities.
And Representative Birch, another question, and after this question or questions, move on to public testimony, because I see there is one person waiting online.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess, speaking beyond the merits of proposal, and I certainly understand the intent, but I'm also kind of trying to think through the unintended consequences. And I know I had somebody in my office this week talking about blood quantum as it relates to whether a person can be a Native American artist, whether they qualify or not, which is kind of an interesting question. But I guess, are there any registries that are currently maintained by the state or instrumentality of the state that relate to whether someone's a Native American, for example, or qualifies for some benefit based on a status that relates to race, religion, ethnicity, or national origin? And I'm not aware of one, but I'm just not certain. And I guess I would be, through the chair, would be, have you researched that, or where do we stand with that?
Well, through the chair, Representative Birch, I think that's a fair question. And I think that my office needs to research that further. We're just trying through this hearing to establish the intent. And it's placed in a statute where it's pretty clear it's a push. This is the quintessential pushback on federal overreach statute that concerns firearms and due process and even the real ID, which frankly I don't know enough about, and I think we all need to learn a lot about in the next year or something happens. I'm not sure what that is, but. So I take your point, and it's a very good point. But I think I'm comforted that it's placed in that family of pushback legislation.
Follow up, Representative Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as to real ID, it's June 6th, from what we've heard, as to when all of a sudden your driver's license will not be effective. I think that deadline is accelerating much more quickly in the governor's proposal to have one or the other. But I appreciate your intent here, and I would appreciate some additional research and making sure that there's no unintended consequences as far as registers that the state or municipality may maintain. Thank you, sir.
And Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Tuck, closing comment.
Chair, and the question earlier was, is there anybody contemplating these types of activities? And what I like about this bill is it prevents anyone from even contemplating it. I mean, why wait till someone's contemplating before doing something? And one of the problems that we're having right now with the federal government is that we're always reacting to them rather than take a proactive approach. And Real ID is a good example. We put on our statutes, seeing that this was coming down the line, the invasiveness of private citizens of America and trying to protect the residents of Alaska. We passed the bill years ago, and I just want to remind everyone that that we do have some federal overreach provisions coming down on us hard in July that we need to really seriously look at.
Thank you. And at this time, I'm going to move on to public testimony. And I see online we have Valerie Brooks calling in from Ketchikan, opening public testimony. Valerie, welcome to State Affairs this Saturday. And please present your testimony on House Bill 13. And when you do, identify yourself and state your affiliation for the record. And if you can, please limit your comments to a reasonable period of time.
Good morning. My thanks to the committee this morning and to Representative Josephson. This is Valerie Brooks. I'm calling in from Ketchikan. My comments are my own, although I'll identify myself as a public school educator, reading specialist here in Ketchikan. I thank the committee for the opportunity to speak to this bill. I urge support for this and even for further measures that might allow for sanctuary cities and campuses to protect our most vulnerable families and students as they come under attack merely due to where they are from or how they worship. I've witnessed very real fear in my students and in my coworkers who are impacted by the proposed executive orders. the current deportations underway and the proposed registry that's been discussed for months by persons now in positions of authority at the federal level. This is not redundant because it deals with these very current proposals and activities. And I would add, I appreciate the fact that Representative Josephson has spoken about our duty to each other as Alaskans. And we are all humans. We are all deserving of respect and safety, whether documented or undocumented citizens. I urge all to support HB 13 and resist any attempt to create or support a registry based on race or religion, ethnicity, or nationality. Thank you.
And thank you, Valerie, for taking the time and for those comments. I see no one else online, and if there's anyone in the room who would like to testify, you're welcome, but I don't see anyone in the room as well, so I'm going to close public testimony at this time. And at this time, I think, hold the bill, and thank you, Representative Josephson, for presenting it. And I'm going to look to and defer to the will and wisdom of the committee in terms of future consideration of this piece of legislation and rely on you, Representative Josephson, for those conversations and for further direction. But that's the last item on today's agenda. And as a few reminders, our next meeting is Tuesday, February 21st at 3 p.m., and we're also starting weekly standing Tuesday committee meetings at 5:30 p.m. as well. Next week we have a few old pieces of legislation, HB 91 relating to APOC, as well as HB 44 and HCR 1 relating to conflict of interest with the legislature. And then next Thursday we're going to hear HB 82 relating to off-highway driver's licenses and eligibility thereof, and as HB 1 relating to election registration and voting. And I'd like to thank Martha and Kelsey, as always, for your help. Thank you so much. And that's it. Thank you all for coming in on a Saturday. We're adjourned at 12:19 p.m.